This is Robert Scheer with another edition of Scheer Intelligence, where the intelligence comes from my guest, in this case, journalist and author, Mariam Shaheen, who is, I say, a Palestinian, yet you were born in Berlin, I guess. And your father, as with many Palestinians and many Jewish people, lived in the diaspora because of events in their home country, a highly educated man, a cancer researcher, and so forth. And yet you visited Palestine. And what you have managed to do in your work, I should say you're a very famous journalist. Your work has appeared on everything from CBS to Al Jazeera. And you've made, I don't know what, some huge amount of documentaries, I think 80 or something. And, you know, you've studied at Harvard and all sorts of places. But what I loved about your work in preparation for this, and as I was familiar with it, some of it before, is you capture, dare I say it, the ordinary person living in a place like Gaza, and how they eat, how they survive, you know, male, female, children. These are not people who invented the situation. These are not people who have agency of any significance. These are the forgotten people of every intrusion, every war, and they're forgotten. The reason I find your work so powerful is that this is the third rail issue. It's very difficult to have a rational discussion about Israel, Palestine, and so forth. Stereotypes dominate. And the group that is lost are the Palestinians and the people in Gaza. First of all, there are plenty of people who deny they are even a people. Or if they've got problems, it's the result of something else that has nothing to do. And somehow, particularly for people who are very sympathetic to Israel, they are an inconvenience, right? This new state was going to be created. I'm not going to visit the whole history. And somehow, oh, it wasn't a vacant land. There were these people. They had a rich, long history. And somehow that always gets in the way. But one point I want to begin with, because I had some experience even greater than yours or more intimate, I actually was in Gaza at the end of the Six-Day War. And what has always bothered me, and I was in the West Bank and so forth, and I had been in Egypt, and I was, of course, in Israel, that the Palestinians are somehow the only group that are held accountable for what happened in the Six-Day War. Not the Egyptians, not the Jordanians, not really the Syrians, all of whom have had their separate peace, not only with Israel, but in the eyes of the world powers and so forth. The Palestinians, who were actually even then an occupied people, or had the Egyptians control Gaza, you know, Syria controlled the Golan Heights, Jordan controlled the West Bank. So when I was there reporting on it, I kept thinking, wait a minute, the Palestinians didn't have air force, they didn't have guns, they didn't have anything. Why, and I've felt this to this day, why are they the ones who've paid the price? Quite apart from anything else you think about the situation. So let me begin there with you. You have captured the forgotten people, the people in Gaza, people in West Bank and so forth. Tell us about that and the difficulty of doing that kind of journalism, getting that out there. And let me just say, I've talked a long time by way of introduction, so really give me the big picture of what you've tried to do as a journalist, what you've discovered, and so forth.
Well, I think Palestinians, specifically those living under occupation and those who live in the diaspora, have frequently been, or mostly been, objectified by the Western media, not so much by the third world media, but certainly by the Western media, and turned into either poor victims or terrorists. And that's very, very problematic because in my experience, granted that I am a Palestinian, but my many, many visits to both the West Bank and Gaza and the Palestinian communities within Israel, it's very clear to me that they are actually victims of war who have, over generations now, found survival mechanisms. And despite efforts to create conditions of de-development, meaning where there were roads in Gaza, today there are none. Where there were hospitals, they are largely dysfunctional because of the lack of electricity. Where there were schools, they are largely, you know, functioning on threads because of a lack of electricity, a lack of water, and because of constant bombardment over the last 12 years at least. We can see that the tenacity of both the individuals and the communities, led by very tenacious men and women, are not just surviving, they are even thriving. Because I think it is safe to say that before 1948, the Palestinians in Palestine, in historic Palestine, were communities of merchants, of farmers, of traders, of a certain degree of an intellectual class, but they were not fighters. They were not people who had to fight up to then for their own existence, either an existence of daily survival or their existence as a people, as an entity, as a nation, as people who have the same rights as everybody else. So I think war and pressure and prejudice, which came both from the state of Israel and frequently also from Arab states and from the West, created a character which was very vibrant with the spirit of survival and resistance to this enormous effort to negate them, both as individuals and as a people. And that I find the most interesting. So moving from that premise, what I do very often in my films is I try to profile people who are making a difference, who are acting on that instinct of survival, a communal instinct of survival, of a way to make things better for themselves and for others. Women have been certainly at the forefront of this, because at various times in the last 60 years, a large percentage of the male population has been incarcerated. And this, again, inadvertently created strength within the community. So every time they take a blow, whether it's a military blow or a political blow, something new is born, a new form of resistance to that eradication. Now, sometimes that eradication is a physical eradication, and sometimes it's a political, economic, social one. So it works on many levels. And the characters I found, the people I found, as a storyteller, of course, they become characters to me. But the people I found are real, and they're really quite fabulous.
You know, people always object when you draw parallels between people. But what hit me about being a witness to a part of the Six-Day War and so forth were what you just said about the Palestinians, of course, is what drew the idea of a Jewish state. There are people who denied that there was a Jewish people until so many of them were exterminated. And at that time, at the Six-Day War, I recall this vividly, the people who led Israel, the dominant labor party, were people that I felt very comfortable with. They were on the left. They were socialists. I remember, Moshe Dayan, he actually knew Arabic. I remember being with him, he said, very clearly told me when I interviewed him, he said, if you come back and we're still occupying here, it will destroy Israel. Now, whether he believed that or not, I don't know. But the Labor Party people claimed at the time that they were not occupiers, that that they understood the risk of being an occupier, what it would do to your national character. And, you know, this has always been the fear of people who oppose imperial adventures. It's going to turn you into a monster, you know. And yet now we are at a time when the old Labor Party people are considered, what, traitors or irrelevant or something. And you have an out-and-out jingoist, Netanyahu, for example, and he's not even the worst of the bunch. If he's defeated in the current election, you know, probably end up being replaced by somebody even more hawk. They're talking about annexation. They're abandoning the idea of two states. Two states for two people was the slogan before. Now they're going to have already announced an annexing the Golan Heights, and Trump supports that. They're talking about annexing the West Bank and so forth. And the question I want to put to that is, how did this get to be such a third rail issue that we can't even discuss it logically? If you dare say something critical of Israel under Netanyahu, was the big victor in Trump's election, a recognized shifting the embassy, he supports everything the right wing has to do, you're actually accused of anti-Semitism, you know. And on the other hand, what I can't understand about all this is the demonization. And what your journalism, and I wonder what reception you find for your journalism, it goes against that narrative of the innocent Israelis, victims of the Holocaust, who have try only to have a home, and they are threatened by these fanatical terrorist Arabs. Your films and so forth, which do get something of a hearing, but primarily now on Al Jazeera, which is challenged as whether it's real news or not. So just tell me a little bit about your work as a journalist, because you're clearly your intention of your journalism is to record accurately. Your product reeks of a pursuit of truth, of accuracy. And yet, because it's different than the commonly accepted narrative, it's probably difficult to get a venue for it.
Well, I think historically that's correct. Palestinians had difficulty being heard, and difficulty in the West being recognized as equal partners or as people who deserve a fair hearing. But I think that's actually changing. I think as the world, you know, increasingly becomes more polarized, there's more people willing to listen to Palestinians. We have an enormous number of, for example, film festivals, which also show documentaries like the ones I make, and many others across Europe, across Asia, across South America, in Africa, and in the United States, in the land where, you know, some of the biggest opponents of a Palestinian identity and entity govern. So, and only last week you had what's probably the second biggest film festival in Israel, in Haifa, and it was a Palestinian film festival. So I actually think things are changing. And I think things are changing even from the time that I was younger and I began, because we were, and I continue to be, I think, relatively soft-spoken in my attempts also to really convince the other, in this case being the Israeli Zionist Jewish entity, that making real peace with the Palestinians, recognizing the Palestinians as equals and treating Palestinians as such, whether they're citizens of the State of Israel or whether they're in the West Bank and Gaza, is actually a good thing for the Jews. Frankly, I mean, this is because I'm always asked that by Israelis. Is what you're doing good for the Jews? And I always say, I think it's very good. Because if you are able to make peace with Palestinians and live in harmony, 90% of your problems will be over. Because when the world around you, those who are hostile to you, recognize that you are actually a democracy and a state which treats citizens and neighbors as equals, then half your problem is over. So that's the premise from which we're moving. And in the past, you mentioned, and I recognize that in my 25-year history with Israel, there wasn't a call for annihilation. There was a call for sidelining, for maybe expelling, for killing, but not en masse. Today, there is a mentality, a right-wing mentality, which has gripped many, many societies across the world of all shades and religions, and that includes Israel. There are calls to kill an entire people, and there's no reprimand. there's nothing. And this is really scary. So on the one hand, you have a move to the right. On the other hand, you have a greater number of people who are saying, stop. This is not okay. We're in the 21st century. We can't go back. Well, going back is not an option.
Let me push this a little bit because it seems the Labor Party, the peace movement in Israel, Peace Now and so forth, are quite weak.
They're persecuted. The peace movement in Israel is persecuted.
And I, for instance, read Haaretz in English regularly, but it represents a very small percentage, the voices of jingoism and so forth. And you're right about this right-wing jingoistic movement in the world. And one perfect example is the one government that seems to have benefited from interference in the U.S. election was Israel. And you know, by interference, I'm not talking about anything necessarily illegal, even surreptitious. I mean, Netanyahu came to the U.S. Congress and attacked a sitting American president over a major agreement with Iran to control nuclear weapons. And he clearly supported Donald Trump. And Donald Trump, as president, whatever you think of him, has been very supportive of a certain right-wing view of Israel. He has favored moving the embassy. He doesn't talk about a two-state solution. He now talks about annexation of not only the Golan Heights, but the West Bank. I don't know if he wants Gaza or just somehow push that off into the sea. And so you have a very odd circumstance where we have a lot of discussion about Russia's influence. They have gotten nothing. They have sanctions. They have nothing. And I, as a journalist, I find it quite amazing that there's no question raised with Pelosi, with Schumer, with any of the leading Democrats. What is going on? Well, you attack Trump for everything. How come you don't attack him for giving Netanyahu a blank check to do what he wants? It must be frustrating to an observer like yourself, no?
Yes, it is. But I mean, I also we follow American politics, and we're looking very closely at what the different Democrats who are running to lead the Democratic Party are saying about the conflict. The main conflict in the Arab world, which is between Israelis and Palestinians. But there are a few who are actually critical of Israel, and those include Bernie Sanders, certainly, and I think even Beto O'Rourke has come out criticizing Netanyahu, the Netanyahu government. So, I mean, we're taking note. Previously, I'm sorry, nobody was criticizing Israel at all. And the fact that you have two candidates now running who are actually opening their mouth, one of them whom happens to be Jewish, is very rewarding in a sense that things have changed, perhaps because of Trump, because perhaps he went too far to the right, that now some people, at least, are publicly pushing back.
Okay. So, first of all, let me take a break, and then I'm going to push back on you on one thing.
Okay.
We'll be right back with this edition of Sheer Intelligence. I've been talking to Mariam Shaheen, a very well-known journalist, filmmaker, author from Palestine, and who has worked for major news organizations, and does a really powerful series for Al Jazeera. We'll be right back. We're back with Mariam Shaheen, Palestinian journalist, and we're talking about the ordinary folks of Gaza. But before we lose the thread here, one thing that's used to sort of say you can't have peace and justify a hard line is that the people of Gaza have been represented by hardliners, the Hamas movement, who attack even the Palestinian Liberation Organization for it's being too dovish. They are an impediment. And one of the contradictions, while we're doing this interview right now this week, Egypt has moved into Gaza to help negotiations. Israel has made a deal with Hamas, one of the many they make over the years. Is actually a historical record that Israel preferred Hamas originally and supported its creation over the PLO and so forth. And as the irony is that you can always find unattractive characters who are leaders on the other side in anything. In this case, the argument of some really even progressive Jewish organizations, we'd love to have peace, but we can't find anybody to negotiate with. So really, what has happened to these peace efforts?
Well, I think it's erroneous. I haven't heard anybody from the Israeli peace movement actually say that, to be honest. I think there are still Israelis who are part of a peace effort. There were Israeli observers in downtown Hebron who basically documented of settler violence against Palestinians. There's an organization called Checkpoint Watch, which is manned predominantly by retirees, but they stand at checkpoints and they try to monitor and sometimes interfere in behavior of soldiers towards Palestinians. So not everything has stopped, and those who actually want to be involved are involved. There's an association for bereaved parents where both Palestinian and Israeli parents who have lost children or loved ones bond together, and they hold discussions and they organize events. Those are just three of dozens of organizations which actually work on the ground. So to say that Israelis who want peace with the Palestinians have no one to talk to is not true, and these people prove it.
Oh, I'm not saying it's true. What I'm saying is it's used as an excuse, and the irony is Israel gets along with, first of all, gets along with all the people that they were at war with in the Six-Day War. They made peace with Egypt and at one point with Syria and certainly with Jordan. And so the only people that were left out are the Palestinians who were not involved militarily in the Six-Day War. But I do want to push this a little further, because the peace movement in Israel is quite weak now. And I want to bring up, you're a documentary filmmaker, and one documentary that really influenced me a lot was called The Gatekeepers. And it was a documentary, basically an interview with almost all of the former leaders alive of Shin Bet, the domestic organization, which actually controls security on the West Bank and in Israel proper. And the persistent theme in that documentary had a tremendous effect on me. And I actually checked its ratings the other day. And most people give it a very high rating, you know, because what it does, they talk to these people of basically their secret security agency, the heads of it. And these people, you know, when they retired, they said, "We are very worried." Every one of them said, "I am very worried about what this occupation is doing to our soul, our Israeli soul, our sense of ourselves, our feeling about other people." And I think it's probably, with all due respect to your documentaries and others, I mean, as an insight into the cost of militarism, of occupation, is very powerful. And so my question really is, hasn't that prophecy by the former leaders of this Israeli occupation agency, Shin Bet, hasn't it been confirmed that there is a coarsening, and on both sides? But certainly I'm not equating the occupier with the occupied. And I wonder whether there is any hope for a two-state solution or living as one people or what have you. We have a dynamic now that I think has some very ugly potential.
Well, yes. I mean, the ugly potential is playing out almost daily, or daily, we can say. The ugly potential is reality. And I would argue that the reality on the ground, and I think what these former security officials were warning of, is that what they've really done is by diluting, by coarsening the mechanism of the occupation, they've diluted the possibility for a two-state solution. So this is, I think, not what they intended initially. At least that's not what Rabin intended. Even Rabin, I think, wasn't keen on giving up the West Bank, but I think he had envisioned something, a peace, quote unquote, based on economic prosperity, not nationhood of the other. I think that's my understanding of the plan. Neither of those things happened. So now what you have is a return to an occupation, a full occupation of the West Bank and Gaza through military means, different forms, but both through military means, that will create a harsher confrontation. I mean, the Palestinians are essentially unarmed. And many people, as you probably know, compare what's happening with what was happening in South Africa. And to be honest, at the end of the day in South Africa, you have one state with different people. They're living together, not exactly as equals. But the way things are going now, I think almost everybody on both sides this time are in accord that the likelihood of a one-state solution has become much more likely than it was before. And the likelihood of a two-state solution is really fading into the background very fast, day by day. So I think, in reference again to the warnings, I think they were seeing that. And I think it's becoming a reality. And I think then a new battle begins, which will be the battle of one state for two people. I mean, the Swiss did it, the Belgians did it. But those are, of course, light years ahead of anything happening in the Middle East. It's not an impossibility.
So let me ask you to draw upon your expertise. Someone, you are Palestinian, lived in the area, and from my ignorance, you know, when I stumbled upon this issue, when I went to at the end of the Six-Day War, I went into Egypt right at the end, and then I went over to Israel, and I was in other countries. I was shocked at the similarity between the Palestinian people and the Israeli Jewish population. Sometimes I couldn't tell them apart. I couldn't tell the food apart, mannerisms. very often education. They were both people who had a lot of contact with the diaspora. So if they didn't know people in Brooklyn, they knew people in Detroit. There was, in their life in the Arab world, Palestinians had been poorly treated in different Arab countries. They've been locked into certain occupations, and so forth. And so I had, maybe it was totally naive, I had the view that these two people should be able to get along. And there was a lot of manifestation of that. You had, people on the kibbutz movement who believed that and so forth when I would be there. And what happened was somehow religion, in a heavy-handed way, got imposed on this whole thing, on both sides. That most Israelis, from my experience at that time, considered them, or many of them, considered themselves secular. Many of the Palestinians weren't particularly religious, at least the ones I counted. I didn't do any great scientific survey or anything. And religion on both sides seems to have had a truly hardening effect.
Well, I think religion in this case is a retreat, is a safety net, if you will, is a retreat that occurred as a result of failure. I mean, secularism or secular solutions did not take hold and did not create a solution. And the more powerful party, in any situation has the greater responsibility because they are the more powerful party. So they can make the extra concession, be more strategically attuned to what should happen for things to work. But again, after Oslo, assassination of opposition Palestinians continued. It was a bad call. It was simply unwise. Sometimes just let it be. Just let it be, or prosecute people. But this this insistence on vengeance. And I don't think that's just religious. I think people, that's human nature. It has to be controlled, and we have to be above it. And we have to be mature. And that is mainly what is lacking now. A lack of maturity, a lack of wisdom, and a lack of leadership. And I think the results, in some sense, will be disastrous. But perhaps having a one-state solution is the more mature solution, if it will be, a state for all its citizens. I don't think that's what the Zionist movement intended, but that's where it looks like it's going. And there will be clearly a lot of bloodshed on the way, clearly. I mean, it's happening daily.
But how do you get to a one-state solution without having apartheid? Mm-hmm. Whether we did it in the American South and denying black people any political power, or by expelling people. There's a lot of talk of that. I mean, I find it quite ominous that Netanyahu talks about the victor, the spoils of the victors, that the victors are entitled to, for starting with the Golan. But that also has a strategy of deportation, right? Ethnic cleansing. Because what are the numbers right now? If you actually have took both groups and you put them into one state, you might not for long have a Jewish religious majority.
Well, that was the decision of the Israeli leadership. I mean, frankly, that was the decision that they took when they went off the path of peace in the 90s. After signing that accord, the movement diverged. They killed Rabin.
Well, when you say they,
it was one Israeli, but that Israeli man has gotten preferential treatment even in the prison system.
It's good to remind people that the leading Israeli at the time, and certainly one of the great historical figures, Yitzhak Rabin, was killed not by an Arab terrorist, but by a Jewish terrorist. And it did change the course of history.
It did. It did. I mean, there are many people who say that Rabin's intentions were not so great, but it wasn't given a chance. It was assassinated. The chance was killed before it had a chance to actually flourish. And that's one of the tragedies. But we can't link the fate of millions of people to one man. I mean, we have to rise above this. And the Israelis have to realize that what they're doing in the long term is not in their interests. Isolating the Palestinians, killing them, denying them their basic human rights, their rights to equality, is not in their interest. And that's what I'd like to point out to Israelis.
Okay, we're going to have to conclude this, but people listening to this, they're going to say, Shir, you didn't ask the really difficult question. I know you have a group, Hamas. They control Gaza, okay? Now, maybe with Arafat, maybe you could make the argument that he could have accepted peace. You know, after all, he was the partner in the Oslo and so forth. Could you have peace with Hamas? Is it possible? Who speaks for the Palestinians? Now, the irony in that is that Israel actually from time to time seems more favorable, the hard line in Israel, which is the government, to Hamas than it does to the PLO. But really, you're somebody who goes back and forth, who covers this and so forth. Give me the reality check, because I'm just blowing smoke here. I'm based on headlines or whatever. You're there. You deal with these people. Is Gaza run by religious fanatics? There seems to be seething discontent. Will there be a Palestinian leadership that people could negotiate with? To what degree is this all confused by Israeli actions? Take it. Let's end this on your assessment of the prospect for peace and normalcy in this contentious region.
That's a big one. I think the first thing that has to happen, who represents the Palestinian people? The people in occupied Palestine have to vote. This is number one, both in Gaza and in the West Bank. There hasn't been an election since 2006. That's 12 years. It's time for a vote. That's number one. Certainly, Israel is a major interferent, if that word exists, in internal affairs by the sheer fact that there's constant raiding, there's constant bombing in Gaza and killing, there's constant raiding, killing, and incarceration in the West Bank on a daily basis. As long as this continues, no democracy among the Palestinians and an Israeli military assault almost on a daily basis to varying degrees, we can't have peace. So, two things have to happen. The Palestinians have to hold elections. Hamas is a political organization, okay? They want power like all political parties want power. And they've proved in the past that they can very much hold discussions with Israel. And the Israelis know that. But it's not convenient. It's more convenient to say, this is my enemy. Okay? It's more difficult to make peace than to make war. And that's what we're seeing now. I think at the end of the day, of course, it's possible for Palestinians and Israelis to live together. But a lot has to be done. And above everything, there has to be a will. And that will can be expressed at the ballot box. You see, when you vote for the peacemakers, when somebody comes with a program and says, this is what we have to do, and the people say, okay, I'll sign on for that, then we have hope. I don't think it's a hopeless situation, but it's an extremely hard situation, especially for the Palestinians, because they're the ones being killed. I mean, there are a few Israelis being killed also, But it's basically the Palestinians who are being killed. And it is apartheid. I mean, that's what it is. And, you know, I think we all realize that. And the Israelis know that.
So let me conclude this with a notion about the swing of history. You have a region here basically dominated by two forces in history that seem to be played out in most of the world. One is religion, which for much of the world seems to be increasingly irrelevant or interpreted in benign, non-threatening ways. Even very large Muslim populations in Indonesia generally manage to, you know, or I shouldn't say even, and certainly the Catholic Church, which used to fight the Protestant Church, a lot of that is played out and so forth. And yet here in this relatively small geographical area, religion is like it was described, you know, in the biblical era and so forth. So then one question is this hold of religion in this region. The other is the hold of nationalism. Increasingly, we live in a one-world economy and people travel freely and nationalism seems to be on the decline. And well, I mean, people can evoke it when they want to go to war. But you yourself are a very cosmopolitan, sophisticated person who has lived a lot. I'm not putting you down for that. This is true of many people who go from the United States and live in Israel and come back and so forth. And so I guess that's what I would like to conclude. Here we have a part of the world that seems to be in the grip of these two forces that have lost their power, their energy, in much of the rest of the world, nationalism and religion. And there, it makes the region the most threatening, unstable, unsatisfying, destructive area in the world right now. Is that not the sad conclusion?
I think a return to religion is actually almost a global movement and fundamentalisms. I mean, we look at Brazil, we look at India, we look at Eastern Europe, where national identity and using religion, because I think nationalisms use religion to enforce whatever agenda they have. I think it's on the rise everywhere. I think what has happened over the last 15 years outside Palestine and the rest of the Arab world is an attempt to shed the forces of dictators. And these efforts have, in many cases, not in all, Tunisia being a wonderful exception, have religious movements have hijacked these attempts. So I think we need to differentiate between those who use religion as a means to gain power and use nationalisms, and those who want genuine change and better living conditions for the people in their country, which was the case in certainly, again, I say Tunisia, which is the only successful attempt to bring about that change. And unfortunately, everybody had a role to play in that, including the Israelis, but the entire West, all of Europe, the Russians, the Americans, the Iranians, the Turks, everybody joined the cabal. And it's been horrific.
All right. Well, that's a depressing note to end on. But I will remind you, you did say earlier in this interview, you thought that we would get peace in the Middle East, right? That
it has to play itself out, yes.
Yeah. But as a filmmaker, when you photograph these children, when you describe, I mean, that's the great strength. We haven't talked enough about your art and your journalism. But when you capture these people, like Sandy Tolan, who's your friend, who did in his book, you know, Children of the Stone and Lemon Tree, the humanity, that's what drives me crazy about this issue. The Gaza Strip that I visited a half century ago, and Israel that I visited a half century ago, I did not see the big distinction between Arab and Jew, between Israeli and Palestinian on a human level. I felt comfortable with both, okay? And again, there was so much in common of a culture, of a location, of a desert community, what have you. I mean, so much. And in fact, the original hope of the kibbutz movement in Israel was normalcy, right? Tilling the land and so forth. Do you think we could get to a one-state solution where it would be two different people living peacefully under the same roof?
I think a one-state solution in Palestine and Israel is now the only realistic solution. I think the two people will have to work very hard at making it work. And the more powerful of the two ultimately has the greater responsibility. And I think the future lies in mature political action.
Well, okay. I got it back to some optimism, and so we can we can end it there. I want to thank you again, Maryam Shaheen. You can Google her name, and you can get her terrific work. Just to mention a few, I mean, well, first of all, she's the author of Palestine, A Guide, Unheard Voices, Women on Sanctions and War in Iraq. She's written for everyone, from the Christian Science Monitor, The Nation, The Globe and Mail in Canada, The Guardian, etc. Check out her work. Go to Al Jazeera. She's produced nearly 80 documentaries. We haven't done her great journalistic work justice on this podcast. I wanted to tap into your deep insight on the region. I think we've done that. So I thank you again for taking this time. Our engineers have been Kat Yor and Mario Diaz at KCRW. Our producer is Josh Shear. And here at the Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism, the wizard engineer, Sebastian Grubar, has held it all together once again. And we want to thank him and thank the University of Southern California for helping us here. See you next week.